Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. This is a quote. In the United States of America, every independent workers' movement was paralyzed as long as slavery disfigured a part of the republic. Labor in a white skin cannot emancipate itself where it is branded in a black skin. That's a quote from Karl Marx, who was observing the U.S. slavery system. Karl Marx was also a keen observer of the U.S. Civil War. I found that quote in a new book. It's called Karl Marx in America. It's a book that looks at how Karl Marx thought about the United States, but also how the United States, over time, has responded to the works of Karl Marx. It's written by Andrew Hartman. Andrew Hartman's a professor of history at Illinois State University. Again, the book is called Karl Marx in America. Andrew Hartman, it is my good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Thank you so much for having me on, Mitch. I'm excited to be here.
As am I. I enjoyed, and I'm glad that we're going to be able to have a conversation about Karl Marx's views of the United States, of democracy, of slavery, of the Civil War. He wrote for the New York Tribune. I really want to dive into that because that to me is very fascinating. And then we've had moments of Karl Marx sort of ascension and decline when it came to national opinions about Karl Marx. We'll get into that too. But I am talking to you here just a couple of days after large protest occurred across the country, known as the No King's Day, corresponding with President Donald Trump's military parade. We're also at the moment seeing sustained demonstrations in Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, San Francisco. How do you see Karl Marx fitting into this very moment that we're witnessing?
So at least there are at least two ways in which it works. Obviously, I'm sure most of your listeners know that Marx was a critic of capitalism, perhaps the world's most famous critic of capitalism. And our current moment is one of extreme inequality created by the, I guess what you might call our current iteration of capitalism, neoliberal capitalism. So that's one thing. But on the other hand, Marx was also interested in American democracy. Marx was a small D Democrat through and through, and believed early on when he started looking at the United States that democracy might provide a sort of like path towards the socialism of his desire. He thought that, well, in the U.S., where most working class people, at least white men at the time, could vote, why wouldn't they usher in democracy? But he also very quickly realized that capitalism, inequality, the fact that some people had all the wealth and others didn't and had to sell their labor in order to survive, that would warp democracy. And I think we're seeing that to an extreme extent right now in terms of the warping of democracy, the control of democracy by oligarchs, by extremely wealthy people with very little interest in the common good.
Karl Marx was a small D Democrat.
Yes, for sure.
Tell me more about that.
So, of course, in the 20th century, due to the Cold War, Marx is remembered or thought about by Americans as being responsible for perhaps Soviet totalitarianism, authoritarianism, anti-democracy, dictatorship. But Marx was a Democrat in the sense that he thought that people should govern themselves, should rule themselves, should have control over their own lives. So he was in favor of electoral democracy, but he also recognized that at least during his lifetime, electoral democracy was limited in the sense that people didn't have freedom, they didn't have control over their lives while they were at work. In other words, he theorized or kind of observed that a growing number of people across the planet, but especially in Europe and also in the United States, had to sell their labor in order to survive. This was the working class, or what he termed the proletariat. And they had to spend most of their waking hours at work where they were decidedly unfree. They didn't have control over their time, over their bodies, over their minds while at work. And I think this is still true to this day. And so the degree to which Marx has added to American political discourse over the last 170 some odd years is the degree to which American political traditions, we don't have the language for that aspect of freedom, that aspect of democracy, self-rule at the workplace, control of our own labor, control of our own time.
Is his feelings about democracy expressed or can be found? Can they be found in the Communist Manifesto?
Not necessarily in that particular text, which was, co-authored with Frederick Engels and was decidedly a manifesto in the sense that it was a call to arms for the emergent communist movement in Europe against an emerging capitalist class or an emerging bourgeoisie and bourgeois power. And in fact, in that manifesto, Marx speaks kind of famously or infamously about a dictatorship of the proletariat. But, in the context of when he was writing, dictatorship didn't have the sort of negative connotation that it would later gain in the 20th century when we saw some of the world's worst leaders in human history who were dictators. But also, to his mind, a dictatorship of the proletariat, because most people were coming into the working class, were becoming a member of the proletariat. To his mind, that was a much more democratic system than a dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, which was a small class of people.
Yeah, that's interesting, the term dictator. And I never really thought about that, but it didn't have the same kind of meaning that it would have here in the 20th century or in the 20th century. And even if you look at ancient history, it was just an office, the office of dictatorship. It was a position in ancient Rome that you gave temporary power to deal with crises until Caesar changed all of that and made it a permanent position. Again, in your book, Karl Marx in America, you look at a long history of how the United States has responded to Karl Marx. And in a moment, we'll get into more about how Karl Marx saw America. But just sort of outline for me, there are different periods in which people here see Karl Marx quite differently.
Yes. So I trace how Americans respond to Karl Marx really from the U.S. Civil War all the way to the present. And in doing so, I've discovered there are four historical periods in which lots of Americans, nowhere near a majority, but a sizable number of Americans viewed Marx favorably. They read Marx, they wrote about Marx, they interpreted Marx, they tried to put Marx into action to help improve their lives, to help improve American society. And these four periods, what I call the Marx boom periods, were the Gilded Age, so the late 19th century, when you see the emergence of the first large industrial working class and, as such, the labor movement. And then you see a rising socialist movement that eventually comes into being with the Socialist Party of America and Eugene Debs as its leader. And then in the 1930s, during the Great Depression, the world sees capitalism's worst crisis, or at least the U.S. sees capitalism's worst crisis. As many as a third of Americans are unemployed in the Great Depression, and many turn to radical movements, including the Communist Party USA in this time period. And Marx becomes something of a prophet for many of these Americans who are either in the communist movement or in the large growing militant labor movements of the 1930s. And then again in the 1960s, this is a different sort of left, what became known as a new left, because it had different sources of anger and different points of accentuation in terms of its politics. But still, it turns to Marx, even though its points of emphases are less about the economy and more about war, imperialism, and just in general, a sort of existentialist freedom. Lots of young Americans especially turned to Marx during the 1960s in what I consider the third period in which, or the third Marx boom period in which lots of Americans are reading Marx favorably. And I tentatively would argue that now we're living in the fourth Marx boom, at least since 2008 with the financial crisis and the emergence of what some people call millennial socialism. Whether or not this is a full-blown boom or a speculative bubble, I think is yet to be determined.
I mean, it's lasted 17 years if we think we're still in it, right? I mean, that's kind of a sustained period of time. I don't know how you would compare it to other periods.
It is a sustained period of time. The thing that might be different is it's not as in all the other periods, reading Marx favorably and sort of like thinking about Marx and Marxism was attached to a party or movement in ways that's sort of less connected right now, perhaps. I mean, you could argue millennial socialism is what has fed the rapid growth of democratic socialists of America. To a degree, it fed the excitement about the Bernie Sanders campaigns. And there's been a lot of sort of like return to Marx and attempts to understand our current moment of capitalism. Probably because we're living in this current moment, it's difficult to know where we're going with it, I suppose.
In preparing for our conversation, I was thinking to myself, Karl Marx must be the most towering figure on the left. Now there are people on the left don't like Marxism, don't like necessarily Karl Marx either, or his writings. You have anarchists, sometimes they're compatible, sometimes not, anarchist. But if I was trying to think of any figure that could surpass Karl Marx, I couldn't think of one. I mean, he sort of is the towering figure of the left, isn't he?
Yes, that's one of the lessons of my research. It's not really possible to be on the left and not have some sort of take on Marx, whether it's a sophisticated take grounded in years of reading Capital or just a sort of superficial understanding. But Marx is the towering figure of the left. And I think partly because his works emerge at a time with the emergence of industrial capitalism, and he's the most famous, most sustained critic of industrial capitalism. And so many movements take off from his ideas in the late 19th century, especially in Europe, but then increasingly across the globe in the 20th century. And so Marx, there's like, it continually returns, like the return of the repressed Marx over and over again. Marx talked about how the working class was a mole, like continually burrowing under capitalist society and reemerging in new spots. And it seems like that's Marx has become the mole to American capitalism.
Let's get into Karl Marx's day. Again, he was a keen observer of what was happening in the United States. Tell me about Karl Marx and the New York Tribune. He wrote for the New York Tribune, and this is not some small little paper, is it?
Now, the New York Tribune during the 1850s was the most subscribed to newspaper in the world. It had 200,000 subscribers, so to give you a sense of the size of that base. The London Times only had about 100,000 subscribers in the same time period. The New York Tribune was like the newspaper of the emerging Republican Party or the Republican movement. And so,
And
for
this is
example,
the beginning of the Republican Party. This is when it's an abolitionist, well, partially abolitionist party.
yes, it's the Free Labor, Free Men, Free Soil Party. It's the party of Abraham Lincoln. So Marx wrote for the New York Tribune throughout the 1850s. He was its main European correspondent. Charles Dana, who was one of the editors of the paper, traveled to Europe after the revolutions of 1848, seeking out a commentator on European politics for the newspaper, and everyone sort of advised him to go to Marx. So Marx gets hired. It's his main source of income during the 1850s, in addition to supplemental income from his good friend Engels. And he writes over 500 articles for the New York Tribune during this time period. These are like deeply analytical articles, mostly about European and global politics, but Marx always paid close attention to what was happening in the US because he knew he was writing for an American readership, a readership that was hungry for somewhat radical ideas. Republicanism and Marxism had some interesting overlaps during this time period in terms of their rejection of like concentrated power. And so, Marx wrote extensively for an American audience before he was Marx, before anyone knew who this figure was, certainly before he was famous. Most of the articles did not include a byline, so they're written anonymously. So Abraham Lincoln probably read several articles written by Karl Marx during the 1850s without knowing who the author was.
Kind of like The Economist today.
Yes, exactly.
Are you able to go back and trace what articles were his?
Yeah, so the Marx Engels archives have them all there. And for the purposes of my book, there wasn't tons to be learned from them, except that he was deeply interested in how his articles would appeal to Americans who he thought were, at least in terms of his small R Republican readership, were some of the most liberty-loving people in the world. So what's interesting is he had a number of, you know, Marx participated in the 1848 revolutions in Prussia, which would become Germany. Those revolutions failed. Many of the revolutionaries have to go into exile, especially in Prussia, which was autocratic and repressive. Marx and many ended up in London, which is kind of like became a vacuum for political exiles and well into the 20th century. But many of them ended up in the United States, and they become known as the 48ers. And even though most of them, when they came to the U.S., wanted to go back to Germany as soon as possible to sort of pick back up where they left off with the revolutions, they quickly discovered that maybe there were more revolutionary opportunities in the United States, and they joined the Republican Party, they joined the abolitionist movement. Many of them volunteered for the Union Army when the Civil War began. Most of these were German immigrants on the Western Front, so along the Mississippi. And they were working hard to transform the war of one to sort of protecting the Union, a sort of constitutional war, into a revolutionary war that would abolish slavery. And so they had a lot, they had a lot in common with the enslaved themselves, who saw the war as one for freedom.
So I don't know if you can have Marxism during Marx's life, but are these proto-Marxists involved in the Civil War?
Yes, definitely. They kept up correspondence with Marx. They saw him as one of, if not their single most important intellectual leader. Many of them would join the International Working Men's Association, which was founded in 1864 in Europe, and Marx was the intellectual leader of that. Soon after the war, many of them would join various communist clubs or early socialist Marxist parties in the U.S. New York City in particular builds a sort of socialist German immigrant culture that is very much rooted in Marx's ideas. They publish newspapers. They serialize a number of Marx's works. There's this whole sort of German immigrant socialist culture, which I would consider Marxist, yes.
The 1850s has been a period of time that I've been fascinated in for a while now. It's sort of maybe perhaps the most volatile moment in U.S. history domestically. This is the decade before the Civil War, which was, sometimes we're comparing the moment we're living in now to the 1850s with obvious differences. This is the rise of the Republican Party. I said partial abolitionist party because it was anti-slavery and it was meant to take on the slave power of the South, but there was differing views about how far to go in their view, their sense of anti-slavery or against slavery. But there were the radical Republicans. These were like Thaddeus Stevens, Charles Sumner, several others, sort of like driving the agenda at the time. Were they at all in correspondence or any kind of relations with Karl Marx whatsoever?
None that I could discover, but there's a lot of coalescing, especially after the Civil War. So some of these radical Republicans, in addition to focusing on Reconstruction after the Civil War, that is a radical remaking of Southern society that would, to their eyes, create freedom and democracy for all, including the formerly enslaved or the freedmen. They also turn their attention to the growing labor movement. And of course, that was one of Marx's main arguments and main points of focus, is that once slavery in the U.S. and elsewhere was abolished, it would enable for the growth of a working class movement, because they wouldn't workers in a capitalist economy wouldn't have to compete with enslaved workers. And so, in fact, there's a growth of some labor unions in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War. Then they gain shorter work days, both in England and in the US. And people like Thaddeus Stevens and other radical Republicans are paying close attention to this. They're paying close attention also to things in Europe, like the Paris Commune, which happens in 1871. And they see a lot of overlap between their politics and their attempts to restructure or reconstruct American society with what's happening in Europe and the working class movements in Europe. So there's a lot of overlap, and they even start calling themselves Reds, Red Republicans, which is how the German 48ers thought of themselves as well. So there's a lot of overlap, even if.
So there are Republicans who are calling themselves, calling themselves Red Republicans?
Yeah, so the German Republicans in particular were fond of this. Red Republicanism becomes a pejorative in the hands of, I guess, a reactionary right. But some people embrace the term, yes.
Any names we'd recognize or should know of?
Well, so Joseph Wedemeyer is probably the most famous of Marx's comrades whom he kept correspondence with during and after the Civil War. He joined the Union. He was a military leader in the 1848 revolutions alongside Engels, comes to the U.S. for the Civil War, joins the Union Army, and rises up the ranks to major, and is in charge of the theater in St. Louis. He's kind of the commanding officer over St. Louis during the Civil War. He embraces this Red Republicanism, and he writes extensively in the German-American press about the Civil War and Reconstruction, arguing, and this is Marx's argument at the time as well, that during and after war, the thing to do would be to arm black people, arm the formerly enslaved, give them full right to vote, and give them land and redistribute the land of the former slave owners to the formerly enslaved and the white working class throughout the South. He's making this argument, Marx is making this argument, and that's the most radical end of the sort of radical Republican argument at the time.
I mean, Thaddeus Stevens was making a similar argument.
Yes, yes.
During
so there's overlap, and what's interesting is you start to get sort of elements of a Red Scare in this time period, in which people opposed to radical Reconstruction start calling people like Thaddeus Stevens communists. And Marx, beginning in 1871 with the Paris Commune and continuing on to various events in the U.S. and elsewhere, gets blamed by reactionaries in the US and in Europe for these events, even those he had nothing to do with, even events like the Haymarket riot in Chicago, which happens after he's dead.
Oh, that's interesting to me. So they're using the communist as a pejorative during Reconstruction.
Yes.
I mean,
yes,
it's happened many times since.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize it was happening during Reconstruction.
Yes. So historians track and document two big Red Scares in American history. The first Red Scare is the one after the First World War and Bolshevik Revolution. Thousands of immigrant radicals are deported, usually back to Russia. Many are jailed. Some are killed or lynched. It's a really politically repressive time, and the state and local governments use that moment to destroy the militant labor and socialist labor movement and socialist parties, especially the Wobblies or the industrial workers of the world. Then there's the second Red Scare, which is immediately following the Second World War, which is meant to similarly destroy the Communist Party, destroy militant communist organizers in the labor movement, but then takes on a whole other added element in terms of at the cultural and intellectual level. There's a Red Scare in the universities, McCarthyism. But this type of thing has deep roots. It goes all the way back to the 1870s. And almost from the get-go in the 1870s, Marx's name is used as a specter, as a force at work, and to blame for the Paris Commune, to blame for the 1877 Great Railroad Strikes, which also ended up in a general strike in St. Louis. Some people called it the St. Louis Commune of 1877. Reactionaries say this is Marx and Marx's ideas, but because by this point Marx is becoming famous, he really becomes famous in the U.S. for the aside from the German immigrant socialist community, becomes famous in the U.S. Through a glass darkly, as somebody to fear, as a specter of sorts.
This is Letters and Politics, and we are in conversation with Andrew Hartman. Andrew Hartman's professor of history at Illinois State University, and he is the author of the book Karl Marx and America. That is what we are in conversation about. I'm kind of stuck on this 1870s moment. They in the culture wars today, in the political wars today, they blame Marx. They call it cultural Marxism. Just this history of branding the American left with Marxism and communism is, and we've done a lot of shows actually, and we framed them the way you said a lot of historians frame them. The first Cold War is just after World War One and the Bolshevik Revolution. The second Cold War is just after the Second World War. And we have mentioned, but we haven't done really a deep dive into what some, I think, and as you're pointing out, was kind of actually the first, or maybe, I don't even know if it was the first, maybe there's something before it now, but the a previous Cold War in the 1870s. Now, Karl Marx, he's alive at this period, isn't he? I should know this.
Yes. Yeah. So Marx dies in 1883. When he dies, the biggest memorial service to his name happens at Cooper's Union in New York City. Thousands of people attend. It's packed. There's standing room only. They have like rooms on the outside of, they have to sort of like have overfill rooms, overflow rooms. So by the time he dies, he is famous, but it took almost until his death for him to become famous. And as I think I'm intimating, there was, I guess, what you might call a dialectic at effect here, in the sense that, especially in the US, he's becoming someone who's read by the militants, read by the left, read by the growing labor movement, read by the growing socialist movements, but even more so, a name to blame for any effort to sort of level society, any effort to destroy hierarchy, whether that's in the Reconstruction South or whether that's in like the capitalist North.
Does he respond to this?
A
To
little,
how he is being betrayed?
a little. Mostly he's amused by it. So after the Paris Commune, that's really when he becomes famous, because he's blamed for it, even though he had nothing to do with it. You know, those are the 30 days when the Paris left took control of Paris and tried to set up a left-wing or communist government, a commune, before it got utterly destroyed by the French army.
And that was
And
big news here. That helped spur paranoia.
yeah, like massive news around the world, but especially in the US, where capitalists are very not only powerful but jealous of their power. So he was amused by it. After this happened, several American newspapers sent reporters to London to talk to Marx. And I think he played up his growing infamy. He was amused by it, but he didn't reflect on it too much.
Yeah. Again, it's interesting. You mentioned the Gilded Age, which sort of late 19th century. This is when, as you mentioned, you have Eugene Victor Debs on the scene. You have the rise of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. Emma Goldman is hanging out in New York City. And they're not all socialists. Some of them are. Emma Goldman's known as an anarchist. How are they receiving Marx at this time? Well,
So
actually, let
Marx.
me back up. You know, I'm leaving out a big part, because Marx is a part of this. That is the First Internationale.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, their International Working Men's Association, which is known as the First International, it's headquartered at first in Europe, Brussels to be exact, and then kind of headquartered in London, because Marx kind of takes the reins. But there's a struggle over it between Marx and the anarchists, with Bakunin as the sort of leader of the anarchist faction in the International. And rather than lose control to the anarchists, Marx and others moved the headquarters to New York City, because that's where his allies, the German-American socialists, have control of the International. It's not really a move that works. The International dies soon after, but there's a struggle over the International in New York, or in the US, between the German socialists and, I guess, what other historians have referred to as Yankee radicals, who, you know, they liked Marx, but they had other ideas about what it meant to be for freedom, or radical against the system at the time. They were anti-capitalist to some extent, but they were also free love, feminist, kind of anti-bourgeois culture. They would have been like early bohemians, you might say, in a sort of Greenwich Village sense. So yeah, lots of, there's just a lot of this mix going on in terms of various ways to read Marx. But by the time you get to the emergence of the industrial workers of the world, which are formed in 1905, most Americans, if they're reading Marx favorably, are reading him as the great theorist of the labor theory of value, and that is that capitalism works completely. Its whole reason for existence is to make profits for some people by exploiting the working class. And so the argument then goes, the only sort of answer to this system or existence of exploitation is to organize the working class. The more power the working class have through solidarity, the better off your lives are going to be. And that's the sort of premise of the Socialist Party of America under the leadership of Eugene Debs, who becomes a Marxist. That's the rationale of the industrial workers of the world, even though they had different tactics and strategies than the socialists. They believed in this under the leadership of people like Big Bill Haywood. And there's a whole host of other socialist and militant labor unions that sort of take on this element of Marx in this period in their effort to address what the capitalist class called the labor problem or the labor question.
How about, do you look at W.E.B. Du Bois?
Quite extensively. He wrote a book in 1935 called Black Reconstruction in America. I consider it one of the five best books ever written about U.S. history. Really remarkable and ahead of its time. And he wrote that book at a time in which he was experiencing a lot of sort of intellectual energy by reading Marx. He was teaching Capital to his grad students at the time. And he frames the Civil War and Reconstruction in very Marxist terms as a struggle for power between classes. He calls, for example, enslaved workers during the Civil War dropping their tools and fleeing for Union lines. He calls this a general strike. So he's using the language of the 1930s left. He argues that for a short time, radical Reconstruction created one of the greatest dictatorships of the proletariat outside of Russia. He's very much steeped in sort of left-wing Marxist language and a form of analysis, in making the case that actually democracy, there was a moment of democratic and socialist revolution that had the potential in Reconstruction that was lost due to a couple of factors. First of all, that the, I guess, capitalist North kind of withdrew its support for the Union Army in the South, and also that racism came to the fore to divide the working class in the South and elsewhere.
Yeah. His book, Black Reconstruction, you mentioned one of the most important books in U.S. history, undoubtedly so. He helped change the narrative about how we see Reconstruction, the period after the Civil War, in which blacks at the time were for a short period of time, were given rights, were elected to office. Eventually it was reversed, and you had Jim Crow, but it was a very important period of time. Before Black Reconstruction, I think it was portrayed as this utter failure.
Yeah, the dominant historical profession mode of thinking was what was known as the Dunning School, named after a historian at Columbia who had a bunch of students who they interpreted Reconstruction as a failure because black people were not capable of democracy. They weren't sort of like acculturated to democratic values yet. And because there were northern, I guess what you would call carpetbaggers, who were taking advantage of this and were incredibly corrupt and just profiting off of Reconstruction. That was the dominant mode of thinking about Reconstruction all the way up until the 1950s amongst American professional historians. Of course, Du Bois challenged that head on. And Du Bois's argument has won the day. The most important history book about Reconstruction now is Eric Foner's Reconstruction. And he basically empirically fleshed out Du Bois's arguments and proved most of them true.
Yeah. I want to talk more about the 1930s, the Great Depression. We do have a Red Scare after World War I and the Bolshevik Revolution, a very fierce one. People were deported, arrested. It was an intense moment that tried to stamp out, I guess, Marx in this country. But Marx has a comeback in the Great Depression. How does that happen?
Yeah, as you said, the 1920s are a pretty dark era for the left. Marx, I guess you might say, went underground. The Communist Party, which newly emerged out of the Socialist Party crumbling in the wake of the Bolshevik Revolution, goes underground in response to repression. But with the Great Depression in the early 1930s, starts to emerge, and what you also get is a large, unruly industrial working class. That begins to organize at levels never seen before in US history, and successfully. You get the emergence of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, which has a much different approach to organizing the working class. It's what they call industrial unionism or industrial democracy. Basically, everybody should join the union. If you work at an automobile factory, no matter what your role is there, you're joining the UAW. And this is highly successful. There's just a lot of militancy in the working class, so much so that 1934 is what the late great historian Mike Davis refers to as the high water mark of class struggle in US history. This is when you get a general strike in San Francisco led by Harry Bridges and the dock workers. This
Who
is
they
when you
try to
get
deport.
several times. This is when you get strikes up and down the eastern seaboard from Maine all the way down to the Carolinas of textile workers. The working class is extremely riled up. And in this mix, in this context, you see a growing Communist Party, which is gaining more and more numbers and confidence. And you also see lots and lots of people reading Marx. Almost any intellectual worth their salt in this time period, it seems, is digging into Marx and trying to make sense of their world through the lens of Marx. And they're trying to fit Marx to an American context.
And the communists at the time were, am I correct in saying this, do you think, within the fold of this New Deal coalition?
So at first, not. So, the Communist Party, the history of the Communist Party in the US is a really intriguing one to me because the rank and file level, many of them just saw the Communist Party as the best sort of mechanism for organizing in ways that they wanted to organize for things they wanted, like better labor conditions or desegregated pools. It just depends on what the situation was. But at the sort of top level of Communist Party leadership in the US and elsewhere, they were responsive to Moscow. They were responsive to the Communist International. And during up until 1934, 1935, they had a this is known as the third period in the Communist Party. They had a theory that of social fascism, and that is that liberals were like fascists. But all of that changes with the emergence of the Popular Front in 1935, when the Communist International says that communists should work with liberals, communists should move into liberal institutions, whether they're unions or the Democratic Party in the US. In turn, the New Deal, with the second New Deal of 1935, FDR embraces the working class, brings the militant working class into the Democratic fold, so much so that, yes, historians have kind of categorized the Communist Party as a junior partner in the New Deal by the time you get to the middle to the late 1930s. So it's the great Americanization of the left, which had a kind of twofold effect. On the one hand, it really boosts the power of the working class within the Democratic Party coalition. Unions become I guess, a really important component of that coalition. But on the other hand, it defanged the militantism of the party, of the working class. So 1934 might be the high water mark, but once you get the unions working on behalf of FDR and the Democratic Party, they're less militant, and there's sort of like a little bit less Marxism amongst them.
And then it gets really interesting. You have World War II, you have the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War. And there are so many different, ways we can talk about this. But I want to talk about the relationship between liberalism and, I guess, Marxism. This is, in there was a split before, as you said, before this directive came out about trying to work with liberals, the communists, the Marxists saw liberals as fascists. Then they work together as part of this sort of New Deal coalition. Then the Cold War happens and you have a split again.
Yes. During much of the 1930s, there were Marxists and liberals who were not only working together politically, but also intellectually. There was a lot of sort of hybrid mixing and matching going on. One of the most, to me, interesting examples is Sidney Hook, who was a philosopher at New York University, who was a Marxist, but he was also a student of John Dewey, who was the leading philosophic pragmatist, which is much more a philosophy of American liberalism in the sense that it believed that any theory was only worth its salt if it could work out in practice. And Sidney Hook is one of many who's trying to blend pragmatism and Marxism to make it a sort of radical socialist or communist, yes, Marxist, yes, but also American philosophical project. You get a lot of this just intermixing, and the boundaries between liberalism and Marxism are a little bit porous in the 1930s. This comes to a halt with the end of World War II and the Cold War. It, to some degree, the halts come sooner, but it's definitely comes to a halt with the emergence of the Cold War. Soviet Union's the new enemy. And American liberal intellectuals have like a 15 or 20 year project in which they're trying to define what they begin to call the American political tradition or the liberal tradition as inherently American, as inherently anti-communist, anti-Marxist, and anti-fascist, as the thing that is going to save the world. And in doing so, they perform what I would consider a sort of exorcism in that they have to rid Marx from their project. And so almost every famous liberal intellectual in this time period, ranging from the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr to the historian Richard Hofstadter, or Arthur Schlesinger Jr., to the political scientist Louis Hartz, even Hannah Arendt, and the economic historian W.W. Rostow, they're all writing about Marx to prove him wrong and to prove that the American system is superior.
I mean, these are all people who were previously critical of conservatives, right, in the conservative movement.
They still were to some extent, but they really refocused their attention in critiquing the left. Some of this comes out of like the 1848 election in which the Democrat Harry Truman is being challenged on his left
Henry
by
Wallace.
Henry Wallace and the Progressive Party, which the communists supported. This is really about sort of trying to sort of give intellectual bona fides to the Cold War project.
Do you think this is right? The liberals saw themselves as having defeated fascism in World War II. Of course, we're ignoring the role Russia plays in that, but just go along with me on this. That liberals defeated fascism in World War II, and now liberals are going to defeat communists?
Yes. So that's exactly right. And they thought that the world would be best if it would all just embrace American style liberal capitalism or democracy. And so, yes, liberalism defeated fascism. Now it's going to defeat communism. The New Deal proved Marx wrong because the New Deal was part of this social democratic movement in the US and also Northern Europe that made the working class better off than ever. And, Marx had a theory about the immiseration of the working class, that capitalism would make the working class more and more poor. So all of this kind of came together, and they said Marx is wrong, America is right, and America is going to be the future.
So the way that Marx was used to discredit Reconstruction, it's used again to discredit the New Deal.
Conservatives do that for sure. So whereas liberals argued the New Deal proved Marx wrong,
Oh,
conservatives.
I got you. I got you. So they're saying that capitalism can take care of the basic needs of people because of the New
Yes.
Deal. I mean,
Yes.
hence the saying FDR saved capitalism, right?
That's the liberal argument. And FDR himself often would say his goal is to save capitalism, to save American style democracy. They thought of the two as going hand in glove. And FDR, what made him unique is he was willing to be a class traitor of sorts, because he came from an American aristocracy, if you will. But he was willing to challenge certain elements of the capitalist class on behalf of saving capitalism. He understood, I think, that injecting the system with small doses of socialism, injecting the system with at least social democracy, empowering the working class was going to stabilize the system and prevent the United States from going fascist or communist.
Neoconservatism would come out of the liberal intellectual tradition, doesn't it?
Yes.
And also in response to Marx.
Yeah, so neocons, most of whom, many of them were Marxists or even tr or Trotskyists in the 30s and 40s. Most of them became Cold War liberals during the 40s and 50s. By the 60s, many of them turned to neoconservatism, which was a reaction against, I guess, the excesses of American liberalism that they saw both in Great Society liberalism and also in the New Left, the Black Power movement, feminism. It's like, liberalism is good for me, but not for thee. To me, that's the neoconservative mantra.
Yeah, and of course it's the neoconservatives that would bring us the George Bush presidency and the war in Iraq and all of that, and sort of gets to the split. You mentioned Trotsky, right? The split after Lenin's death in Russia, this power struggle between Stalin and Trotsky, and this would be something that would kind of divide the left ever since, including here in America.
Yes, so as you mentioned, Lenin dies. There's a power struggle in the Soviet Union between Stalin and Trotsky. Trotsky, of course, was one of the leading Bolsheviks in the Bolshevik Revolution, led the Red Army throughout the Civil War that followed the Bolshevik Revolution. But Stalin was a brilliant bureaucratic consolidator and had consolidated power in the various Soviet bureaucracies around him, wins that power struggle. And out of that, you get an ideological division about the future of communism and how to read Marx as well. But on the one hand, Stalin was mostly interested in sort of building up power in the Soviet Union and making the Soviet Union, I guess, like a strong nation that would represent communism, a sort of city on a hill for communism, in the same way that maybe people have often thought of the US for capitalism or democracy. On the other hand, Trotsky argued that socialism in one country would always fail as it's encircled by the capitalist country, so you'd have permanent revolution elsewhere. So the Trotskyist parties that formed as part of what became known as the Fourth International across the world, including in the US, argued that we couldn't just look to the Soviet Union, especially since Stalin, was responsible for helping to destroy radicalism or revolutionary spirit in the Soviet Union and elsewhere. We had to look to ourselves or look elsewhere, and Trotsky became the leader of this sort of like permanent revolutionary coalition. But the Trotskyists, as because they were more skeptical of the Soviet Union at times, they were also skeptical of just the greater left or Marxist project. And so many of them, after discovering the true crimes, the full extent of the crimes of Stalin with the purges, in which he wiped out the entire Bolshevik revolutionary class of people, they kind of blamed the left. Some of them blamed the left and Marxism entirely, and that's why many of them kind of made a U-turn on the ideological, made an ideological shift towards the right, sometimes through Cold War liberalism. But many of them, people like Sidney Hook, previously mentioned, but also James Burnham, pretty famous Trotskyist American intellectual, they become full-blown conservatives, writers, example, and by the 1960s for William Buckley's National Review.
Andrew Hartman has been our guest. Andrew Hartman's professor of history at Illinois State University. He has joined us for a conversation about his book. It's called Karl Marx in America. Andrew Hartman, that was fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mitch. This was a fun conversation.